Come with me, the doctor says. Mr. Green, you will please stand back next to the counter while Lieutenant Sawyer and I step into the hallway. Anything you say, Green executes a mocking bow and moves lightly with a suggestion of dance steps to the counter. In your absence, I'm sure this handsome young man and I will find something to talk about. Smiling, Wendell Green props his elbows on the counter and watches Jack and Dr. Spiegelman leave the room. Their footsteps click against the floor tiles until it sounds as though they have gone more than halfway down the corridor. Then there is silence. Still smiling, Wendell about faces and finds the attendant openly staring at him. I read you all the time, the boy says. You write real good. Wendell's smile becomes beatific. Handsome and intelligent. What a stunning combination. Tell me your name. Ethan Evans. Ethan, we do not have much time here, so let's make this snappy. Do you think responsible members of the press should have access to information the public needs? You bet. And wouldn't you agree that an informed press is one of our best weapons against monsters like the fishermen? A single vertical wrinkle appears between Ethan Evans's eyebrows. Weapons? Let me put it this way. Isn't it true that the more we know about the fisherman, the better chance we have of stopping him? The boy nods, and the wrinkle disappears. Tell me, do you think the doctor is going to let Sawyer use his office? Probably, yeah, Evans says. But I don't like the way that Sawyer guy works. He's a police brutality. Like when they hit people to make them confess, that's brutality. I have another question for you. Two questions, really. Is there a closet in Dr. Spiegelman's office? And is there some way you could take me there without going through that corridor? Oh, Evans's dim eyes momentarily shine with understanding. You want to listen? Listen and record. Wendell Green taps the pocket that contains his cassette recorder. For the good of the public at large, God bless them one and all. Well, maybe, yeah, the boy says. But Dr. Spiegelman, he... A $20 bill has magically appeared, folded around the second finger of Wendell Green's right hand. Act fast, and Dr. Spiegelman will never know a thing. Right, Ethan? Ethan Evans snatches the bill from Wendell's hand and motions him back behind the counter, where he opens a door and says, "Come on, hurry." Low lights burn at both ends of the dark corridor. Dr. Spiegelman says, "I gather that my patient's husband told you about the tape she received this morning." "He did. How did it get here, do you know?" "Believe me, Lieutenant, after I saw the effect that tape had on Mrs. Marshall and listened to it myself, I tried to learn how it reached my patient. All of our mail goes through the hospital's mailroom before being delivered, all of it, whether to patients, medical staff, or administrative offices. From there, a couple of volunteers deliver it to the addresses. I gather that the package containing the tape was in the hospital mailroom when a volunteer looked in there this morning. Because the package was addressed only with my patient's name, the volunteer went to our general information office. One of the girls brought it up. Shouldn't someone have consulted you before giving the tape and a cassette player to Judy? Of course. Nurse Bond would have done so immediately, but she is not on duty today. Nurse Rack, who is on duty, assumed that the address referred to a childhood nickname and thought that one of Mrs. Marshall's old friends had sent her some music to cheer her up. And there is a cassette player in the nurse's station, so she put the tape in the player and gave it to Mrs. Marshall. In the gloom of the corridor, the doctor's eyes take on a sardonic glint. Then, as you might imagine, all hell broke loose. Mrs. Marshall reverted to the condition in which she was first hospitalized, which takes in a range of alarming behaviors. Fortunately, I happened to be in the hospital, and when I heard what had happened, I ordered her sedated and placed in a secure room. A secure room, Lieutenant, has padded walls. Mrs. Marshall had reopened the wounds to her fingers, and I did not want her to do any more damage to herself. Once the sedative had taken effect, I went in and talked to her. I listened to the tape. Perhaps I should have called the police immediately, but my first responsibility is to my patient, and I called Mr. Marshall instead. From where? From the secure room with my cell phone. Mr. Marshall, of course, insisted on speaking to his wife, and she wanted to speak to him. She became very distraught during their conversation, and I had to give her another mild sedative. When she calmed down, I went out of the room and called Mr. Marshall again to tell him more specifically about the contents of the tape. Do you want to hear it? Not now, Doctor, thanks. But I do want to ask you about one aspect of it. Then ask. Fred Marshall tried to imitate the way you had reproduced the accent of the man who made the tape. Did it sound like any recognizable accent to you? German, maybe? I've been thinking about that. It was sort of like a Germanic pronunciation of English, but not really. If it sounded like anything recognizable, it was English spoken by a Frenchman trying to put on a German accent, if that makes sense to you. But really, I've never heard anything like it. From the start of this conversation, Dr. Spiegelman has been measuring Jack, assessing him according to standards Jack cannot even begin to guess. His expression remains as neutral and impersonal as that of a traffic cop. Mr. Marshall informed me that he intended to call you. It seems that you and Mrs. Marshall have formed a rather extraordinary bond. She respects your skill at what you do, which is to be expected. But she also seems to trust you. Mr. Marshall asks that you be allowed to interview his wife, and his wife tells me that she must talk to you. Then you should have no problems with letting me see her in private for half an hour. Dr. Spiegelman's smile is gone as soon as it appears. My patient and her husband have demonstrated their trust in you, Lieutenant Sawyer. But that is not the issue. The issue is whether or not I can trust you. Trust me to do what? A number of things. Primarily, to act in the best interest of my patient. To refrain from unduly distressing her, also from giving her false hopes. My patient has developed a number of delusions centered on the existence of another world somehow contiguous to ours. She thinks her son is being held captive in this other world. I must tell you, Lieutenant, that both my patient and her husband believe you are familiar with this fantasy world. That is, my patient accepts this belief wholly, and her husband accepts it only provisionally, on the grounds that it comforts his wife. I understand that. There is only one thing Jack can tell the doctor now, and he says it. And what you should understand is that in all of my conversations with the Marshals, I have been acting in my unofficial capacity as a consultant to the French Landing Police Department and its chief, Dale Gilbertson. Your unofficial capacity? Chief Gilbertson has been asking me to advise him on his conduct of the fisherman investigation, and 2 days ago, after the disappearance of Tyler Marshall, I finally agreed to do what I could. I have no official status whatsoever. I'm just giving the chief and his officers the benefit of my experience. Let me get this straight, Lieutenant. You have been misleading the Marshals as to your familiarity with Mrs. Marshall's delusional fantasy world. I'll answer you this way, Doctor. We know from the tape that the fisherman really is holding Tyler Marshall captive. We could say that he is no longer in this world, but in the fisherman's. Dr. Spiegelman raises his eyebrows. Do you think this monster inhabits the same universe that we do? Asks Jack. I don't, and neither do you. The fisherman lives in a world all his own, one that operates according to fantastically detailed rules he has made up or invented over the years. With all due respect, my experience has made me far more familiar with structures like this than the Marshals, the police, and, unless you have done a great deal of work with psychopathic criminals, even you. I'm sorry if that sounds arrogant, because I don't mean it that way. You're talking about profiling, something like that? Years ago, I was invited into a special VICAP profiling unit run by the FBI. And I learned a lot there, but what I'm talking about now goes beyond profiling. And that's the understatement of the year, Jack says to himself. Now it's in your court, Doctor. Spiegelman nods slowly. The distant glow flashes in the lenses of his glasses. I think I see, yes. He ponders. He sighs, crosses his arms over his chest, and ponders some more. Then he raises his eyes to Jack's. All right, I'll let you see her, alone, in my office, for 30 minutes. I wouldn't want to stand in the way of advanced investigative procedure. Thank you, Jack says. This will be extremely helpful, I promise you. I have been a psychiatrist too long to believe in promises like that, Lieutenant Sawyer, but I hope you succeed in rescuing Tyler Marshall. Let me take you to my office. You can wait there while I get my patient and bring her there by another hallway. It's a little quicker. Dr. Spiegelman marches to the end of the dark corridor and turns left, then left again, pulls a fat ball of keys from his pocket, and opens an unmarked door. Jack follows him into a room that looks as though it had been created by combining two small offices into one. Half of the room is taken up by a long wooden desk, a chair, a glass-topped coffee table stacked with journals and filing cabinets. The other half is dominated by a couch and the leather recliner placed at its head. Georgia O'Keeffe posters decorate the walls. Behind the desk stands a door Jack assumes opens into a small closet. The door directly opposite, behind the recliner and at the midpoint between the two halves of the office, looks as though it leads into an adjoining room. As you see, Dr. Spiegelman says, I use this space as both an office and a supplementary consulting room. Most of my patients come in through the waiting room, and I'll bring Mrs. Marshall in that way. Give me 2 or 3 minutes. Jack thanks him, and the doctor hurries out through the door to the waiting room. In the little closet, Wendell Green slides his cassette recorder from the pocket of his jacket and presses both it and his ear to the door. His thumb rests on the record button, and his heart is racing. Once again, Western Wisconsin's most distinguished journalist is doing his duty for the man in the street. Too bad it's so blasted dark in that closet, but being stuffed into a black hole is not the first sacrifice Wendell has made for his sacred calling. Besides, all he really needs to see is the little red light on his tape recorder. Then, a surprise. Although Dr. Spiegelman has left the room, here is his voice asking for Lieutenant Sawyer. How did that Freudian quack get back in without opening or closing a door? And what happened to Judy Marshall? Lieutenant Sawyer, I must speak to you. Pick up the receiver. You have a call, and it sounds urgent. Of course. He is on the intercom. Who can be calling Jack Sawyer, and why the urgency? Wendell hopes that Golden Boy will push the telephone speaker button, but alas, Golden Boy does not, and Wendell must be content with hearing only one side of the conversation. A call? Jack says. Who's it from? He refused to identify himself, the doctor says. Someone you told you'd be visiting Ward D? Beezer, with news of Black House. How do I take the call? Just punch the flashing button, the doctor says. Line 1. I'll bring in Mrs. Marshall when I see you're off the line. Jack hits the button and says, Jack Sawyer. Thank God, says Beezer St. Pierre's honey and tobacco voice. Hey, man, you gotta get over to my place. The sooner the better. Everything got messed up. Did you find it? Oh, yeah. We found Black House, all right. It didn't exactly welcome us. That place wants to stay hidden, and it lets you know. Some of the guys are hurting. Most of us will be okay, but Mouse, I don't know. He got something terrible from a dog bite, if it was a dog, which I doubt. Doc did what he could, but, hell, the guy's out of his mind, and he won't let us take him to the hospital. Beezer, why don't you take him anyway if that's what he needs? We don't do things that way. Mouse hasn't stepped inside a hospital since his old man croaked in one. He's twice as scared of hospitals as of what's happening to his leg. If we took him to La Riviere General, he'd probably drop dead in the ER. And if he didn't, he'd never forgive you. You got it. How soon can you be here? I still have to see the woman I told you about. Maybe an hour, not much longer than that anyhow. Didn't you hear me? Mouse is dying on us. We got a whole lot of things to say to each other. I agree, Jack says. Work with me on this, Bees. He hangs up, turns to the door near the consulting room chair, and waits for his world to change. What the hell was that all about, Wendell wonders. He has squandered 2 minutes worth of tape on a conversation between Jack Sawyer and the dumb SOB who spoiled the film that should have paid for a nice car and a fancy house on a bluff above the river, and all he got was worthless crap. Wendell deserves the nice car and the fancy house, has earned them thrice over, and his sense of deprivation makes him seethe with resentment. Golden boys get everything handed to them on diamond-studded salvers, people fall all over themselves to give them stuff they don't even need, but a legendary, selfless, working stiff, and gentleman of the press like Wendell Green? It costs Wendell Green $20 to hide in a dark, crowded little closet just to do his job. His ears tingle when he hears the door open. The red light burns, the faithful recorder passes the ready tape from spool to spool, and whatever happens now is going to change everything. Wendell's gut, that infallible organ, his best friend, warms with the assurance that justice will soon be his. Dr. Spiegelman's voice filters through the closet door and registers on the spooling tape. I'll leave you two alone now. Golden Boy. Thank you, Doctor. I'm very grateful. Dr. Spiegelman. 30 minutes, right? That means I'll be back at... 2:10. Golden Boy, fine. The soft closing of the door, the click of the latch. Then long seconds of silence. Why aren't they talking to each other? But of course, the question answers itself. They're waiting for fat-ass Spiegelman to move out of hearing range. Oh, this is just delicious, that's what this is. The whisper of Golden Boy's footsteps moving toward that door all but confirms the sterling reporter's intuition. O gut of Wendell Green, O instrument marvelous and trustworthy, once more you come through with the journalistic goods. Wendell hears, the machine records, the inevitable next sound, the click of the lock. Judy Marshall, don't forget the door behind you. Golden Boy, how are you? Judy Marshall, much, much better now that you're here. The door, Jack. Another set of footsteps, another mistakable sliding into place of a metal bolt. Soon to be ruined, boy. I've been thinking about you all day. I've been thinking about this. The harlot, the whore, the slut. Is half an hour long enough? Him with foot in bear trap. If it isn't, he'll just have to bang on the doors. Wendell barely restrains himself from crowing with delight. These two people are actually going to have sex together. They're going to rip off their clothes and have at it like animals. Man, talk about your paybacks. When Wendell Green is done with him, Jack Sawyer's reputation will be lower than the fisherman's. Judy's eyes look tired. Her hair is limp, and her fingertips wear the startling white of fresh gauze. But besides registering the depth of her feeling, her face glows with the clear, hard-won beauty of the imaginative strength she called upon to earn what she has seen. To Jack, Judy Marshall looks like a queen falsely imprisoned. Instead of disguising her innate nobility of spirit, the hospital gown and the faded nightdress make it all the more apparent. Jack takes his eyes from her long enough to lock the second door, then takes a step toward her. He sees that he cannot tell her anything she does not already know. Judy completes the movement he has begun. She moves before him and holds out her hands to be grasped. I've been thinking about you all day, he says, taking her hands. I've been thinking about this. Her response takes in everything she has come to see, everything they must do. Is half an hour long enough? If it isn't, he'll just have to bang on the doors. They smile. She increases the pressure on his hands. Then let him bang. With the smallest, slightest tug, she pulls him forward, and Jack's heart pounds with the expectation of an embrace. What she does is far more extraordinary than a mere embrace. She lowers her head, and with two light, dry brushes of her lips, kisses his hands. Then she presses the back of his right hand against her cheek and steps back. Her eyes kindle. "You know about the tape." He nods. "I went mad when I heard it. But sending it to me was a mistake. He pushed me too hard. Because I fell right back into being that child who listened to another child whispering through a wall. I went crazy and I tried to rip the wall apart. I heard my son screaming for my help. And he was there, on the other side of the wall. Where you have to go. Where we have to go. Where we have to go, yes. But I can't get through the wall, and you can. So you have work to do, the most important work there could be. You have to find Tai, and you have to stop the Abala. I don't know what that is exactly, but stopping it is your job. Am I saying this right? You are a coppiceman.
You're saying it right, Jack says. I am a coppiceman. That's why it's my job.
Then this is right, too. You have to get rid of Gorg and his master, Mr. Munshun. That's not what his name really is, but it's what it sounds like, Mr. Munshun. When I went mad and I tried to rip through the world, she told me, and she could whisper straight into my ear. I was so close.
What does Wendell Green, ear and whirling tape recorder pressed to the door, make of this conversation? It is hardly what he expected to hear, the animal grunts and moans of desire busily being satisfied. Wendell Green grinds his teeth. He stretches his face into a grimace of frustration.
"I love that you've let yourself see," says Jack. "You're an amazing human being. There isn't a person in 1,000 who could even understand what that means, much less do it."
"You talk too much," Judy says.
"I mean, I love you.
In your way, you love me. But you know what? Just by coming here, you made me more than I was. There's this sort of beam that comes out of you, and I just locked onto that beam. Jack, you lived there, and all I could do was peek at it for a little while. That's enough, though. I'm satisfied. You and Ward D, you let me travel.
What you have inside you lets you travel.
Okay. 3 cheers for a well-examined spell of craziness. Now it's time. You have to be a coppiceman. I can only come halfway, but you'll need all your strength.
I think your strength is going to surprise you.
Take my hands and do it, Jack. Go over. She's waiting, and I have to give you to her. You know her name, don't you?
He opens his mouth, but cannot speak. A force that seems to come from the center of the earth surges into his body, rolling electricity through his bloodstream, tightening his scalp, sealing his trembling fingers to Judy Marshall's, which also tremble. A feeling of tremendous lightness and mobility gathers within all the hollow spaces of his body. At the same time, he has never been so aware of his body's obduracy, its resistance to flight. When they leave, he thinks, it'll be like a rocket launch. The floor seems to vibrate beneath his feet. He manages to look down the length of his arms to Judy Marshall, who leans back with her head parallel to the shaking floor, eyes closed, smiling in a trance of accomplishment. A band of shivery white light surrounds her. Her beautiful knees, her legs shining beneath the hem of the old blue garment, her bare feet planted. That light shivers around him, too. All of this comes from her, Jack thinks, and from... A rushing sound fills the air, and the Georgia O'Keeffe prints fly off the walls. The low couch dances away from the wall, papers swirl up from the jittering desk. A skinny halogen lamp crashes to the ground. All through the hospital, on every floor, in every room and ward, beds vibrate, television sets go black, instruments rattle in their rattling trays, lights flicker. Toys drop from the gift shop shelves, and the tall lilies skid across the marble in their vases. On the fifth floor, light bulbs detonate into showers of golden sparks. The hurricane noise builds, builds, and with a great whooshing sound becomes a wide, white sheet of light, which immediately vanishes into a pinpoint and is gone. Gone, too, is Jack Sawyer, and gone from the closet is Wendell Green. Sucked into the territories, blown out of one world and sucked into another, blasted and dragged, man, we're 100 levels up from the simple, well-known flip. Jack is lying down, looking up at a ripped white sheet that flaps like a torn sail. A quarter of a second ago, he saw another white sheet, one made of pure light and not literal like this one. The soft, fragrant air blesses him. At first he is conscious only that his right hand is being held, then that an astonishing woman lies beside him, Judy Marshall. No, not Judy Marshall, whom he does love in his way, but another astonishing woman, who once whispered to Judy through a wall of night, and has lately drawn a great deal closer. He had been about to speak her name when, into his field of vision, moves a lovely face, both like and unlike Judy's. It was turned on the same lathe, baked in the same kiln, chiseled by the same besotted sculptor, but more delicately, with a lighter, more caressing touch. Jack cannot move for wonder. He is barely capable of breathing. This woman, whose face is above him now, smiling down with a tender impatience, has never been married or born a child, never traveled beyond her native territories, never flown in an airplane, driven a car, switched on a television, scooped ice ready-made from the freezer, or used a microwave. And she is radiant with spirit and inner grace. She is, he sees, lit from within. Humor, tenderness, compassion, intelligence, strength glow in her eyes and speak from the curves of her mouth, from the very molding of her face. He knows her name, and her name is perfect for her. It seems to Jack that he has fallen in love with this woman in an instant, that he enlisted in her cause on the spot. And at last he finds he can speak her perfect name. Sophie. Chapter 21. Sophie. Still holding her hand, he gets to his feet, pulling her up with him. His legs are trembling. His eyes feel hot and too large for their sockets. He is terrified and exalted in equal, perfectly equal measure. His heart is hammering, but oh, the beats are sweet. The second time he tries, he manages to say her name a little louder, but there's still not much to his voice, and his lips are so numb they might have been rubbed with ice. He sounds like a man just coming back from a hard punch in the gut. Yes. Sophie. Yes. Sophie. Yes. There's something weirdly familiar about this, him saying the name over and over, and her giving back that simple affirmation. Familiar and funny. And it comes to him. There's a scene almost identical to this in The Terror of Deadwood Gulch, after one of the Lazy Eight Saloon's patrons has knocked Bill Towns unconscious with a whiskey bottle. Lily, in her role as sweet Nancy O'Neill,
tosses a bucket of water in his face, and when he sits up, they...
This is funny, Jack says. It's a good bit. We should be laughing.
With the slightest of smiles, Sophie says,
Yes.
Laughing our fool heads off.
Yes.
Our tarnal heads off.
Yes.
I'm not speaking English anymore, am I?
No.
He sees two things in her blue eyes. The first is that she doesn't know the word English. The second is that she knows exactly what he means.
Sophie.
Yes.
Sophie, Sophie, Sophie.
Trying to get the reality of it. Trying to pound it home like a nail. A smile lights her face and enriches her mouth. Jack thinks of how it would be to kiss that mouth, and his knees feel weak. All at once he is 14 again, and wondering if he dares give his date a peck goodnight after he walks her home.
Yes, yes, yes,
she says, the smile strengthening. And then,
have you got it yet? Do you understand that you're here, and how you got here?
Above and around him, billows of gauzy white cloth flap and sigh like living breath. Half a dozen conflicting drafts gently touch his face and make him aware that he carried a coat of sweat from the other world and that it stinks. He arms it off his brow and cheeks in quick gestures, not wanting to lose sight of her for longer than a moment at a time. They are in a tent of some kind. It's huge, many-chambered, and Jack thinks briefly of the pavilion in which the Queen of the Territories, his mother's twinner, lay dying. That place had been rich with many colors, filled with many rooms, redolent of incense and sorrow, for the Queen's death had seemed inevitable. Sure, only a matter of time. This one is ramshackle and ragged. The walls and the ceiling are full of holes, and where the white material remains whole, it's so thin that Jack can actually see the slope of land outside and the trees that dress it. Rags flutter from the edges of some of the holes when the wind blows. Directly over his head, he can see a shadowy maroon shape, some sort of cross.
Jack, do you understand how you...
Yes, I flipped. Although that isn't the word that comes out of his mouth. The literal meaning of the word that comes out seems to be Horizon Road. And it seems that I sucked a fair number of Spiegelman's accessories with me. He bends and picks up a flat stone with a flower carved on it. I believe that in my world, this was a Georgia O'Keeffe print. And that, he points to a blackened, fireless torch leaning against one of the pavilion's fragile walls, I think that was a... But there are no words for it in this world, and what comes out of his mouth sounds as ugly as a curse in German. Halogen lamp. She frowns.
Haldogen limp? Lamp?
He feels his numb lips rise in a little grin. Never mind.
But you are all right.
He understands that she needs him to be all right, and so he'll say that he is. But he's not. He is sick, and glad to be sick. He is one love-struck daddy, and wouldn't have it any other way. If you discount how he felt about his mother, a very different kind of love, despite what the Freudians might think, it's the first time for him. Oh, he certainly thought he had been in and out of love. But that was before today. Before the cool blue of her eyes, her smile. And even the way the shadows thrown by the decaying tent fleet across her face like schools of fish. At this moment he would try to fly off a mountain for her if she asked, or walk through a forest fire, or bring her polar ice to cool her tea. And those things do not constitute being all right. But she needs him to be. Tyler needs him to be. I am a coppiceman. He thinks. At first the concept seems insubstantial compared to her beauty, to her simple reality. But then it begins to take hold, as it always has.
What else brought him here, after all? Brought him against his will and all his best intentions.
Jack?
Yes, I'm all right. I've flipped before. But never into the presence of such beauty, he thinks. That's the problem. You're the problem, my lady.
Yes. To come and go is your talent. One of your talents. So I have been told.
By whom?
Shortly, she says. Shortly. There's a great deal to do. And yet I think I need a moment. You rather take my breath away.
Jack is fiercely glad to know it. He sees he is still holding her hand, and he kisses it, as Judy kissed his hands in the world on the other side of the wall from this one. And when he does, he sees the fine mesh of bandage on the tips of three of her fingers. He wishes he dared to take her in his arms, but she daunts him, her beauty and her presence. She is slightly taller than Judy, a matter of 2 inches, surely no more. And her hair is lighter, the golden shade of unrefined honey spilling from a broken comb. She is wearing a simple cotton robe, white, trimmed with a blue that matches her eyes. The narrow V-neck frames her throat. The hem falls to just below her knees. Her legs are bare, but she's wearing a silver anklet on one of them, so slim it's almost invisible. She is fuller-breasted than Judy, her hips a bit wider. Sisters, you might think, except that they have the same spray of freckles across the nose and the same white line of scar across the back of the left hand. Different mishaps caused that scar, Jack has no doubt, but he also has no doubt that those mishaps occurred at the same hour of the same day. You're her twinner, Judy Marshall's twinner. Only the word that comes out of his mouth isn't twinner. Incredibly, dopily, it seems to be harp. Later he will think of how the strings of a harp lie close together, only a finger's touch apart. And he will decide that word isn't so foolish after all. She looks down, her mouth drooping, then raises her head again and tries to smile.
Judy, on the other side of the wall. When we were children, Jack, we spoke together, often. Even when we grew up, although then we spoke in each other's dreams.
He is alarmed to see tears forming in her eyes and then slipping down her cheeks.
Have I driven her mad? Run her to lunacy? Please say I haven't.
Nah, Jack says. She's on a tightrope, but she hasn't fallen off yet. She's tough, that one.
You have to bring her Tyler back to her, Sophie tells him, for both of us. I've never had a child. I cannot have a child. I was mistreated, you see, when I was young. Mistreated by one you knew well.
A terrible certainty forms in Jack's mind. Around them, the ruined pavilion flaps and sighs in the wonderfully fragrant breeze. Was it Morgan? Morgan of Oris? She bows his head, and perhaps this is just as well. Jack's face is, at that moment, pulled into an ugly snarl. In that moment, he wishes he could kill Morgan Sloat's twinner all over again. He thinks to ask her how she was mistreated, and then realizes he doesn't have to. How old are you?
12, she says.
As Jack has known, she would say. It happened that same year, the year when Jackie was 12 and came here to save his mother. Or did he come here? Is this really the territories? Somehow it doesn't feel the same. Almost, but not quite. It doesn't surprise him that Morgan would rape a child of 12 and do it in a way that would keep her from ever having children. Not at all. Morgan Sloat, sometimes known as Morgan of Oris, wanted to rule not just one world or two, but the entire universe. What are a few raped children to a man with such ambitions? She gently slips her thumbs across the skin beneath his eyes. It's like being brushed with feathers. She's looking at him with something like wonder.
Why do you weep, Jack?
The past, he says. Isn't that always what does it? And thinks of his mother, sitting by the window, smoking a cigarette, and listening while the radio plays Crazy Arms. Yes, it's always the past. That's where the hurt is, all you can't get over. Perhaps so, she allows. But there's no time to think about the past today. It's the future we must think about today. Yes, but if I could ask just a few questions. All right, but only a few. Jack opens his mouth, tries to speak, and makes a comical little gaping expression when nothing comes out. Then he laughs. You take my breath away, too, he tells her. I have to be honest about that. A faint tinge of color rises in Sophie's cheeks, and she looks down. She opens her lips to say something, then presses them together again. Jack wishes she had spoken and is glad she hasn't, both at the same time. He squeezes her hands gently, and she looks up at him, blue eyes wide. Did I know you when you were 12? She shakes her head. But I saw you, perhaps, in the Great Pavilion. My mother was one of the good queen's handmaidens. I was another, the youngest. You could have seen me then. I think you did see me. Jack takes a moment to digest the wonder of this. Then goes on. Time is short. They both know this. He can almost feel it fleeting. You and Judy are twinners. But neither of you travel. She's never been in your head over here, and you've never been in her head over there. You talk through a wall. Yes. When she wrote things, that was you whispering through the wall. Yes. I knew how hard I was pushing her, but I had to. It's not just a question of restoring her child to her, important as that may be. There are larger considerations. Such as? She shakes her head. I am not the one to tell you. The one who will is much greater than I. He studies the tiny dressings that cover the tips of her fingers and muses on how hard Sophie and Judy have tried to get through that wall to each other. Morgan Sloat could apparently become Morgan of Oris at will. As a boy of 12, Jack had met others with that same talent. Not him, he was single-natured and had always been Jack in both worlds. Judy and Sophie, however, have proved incapable of flipping back and forth in any fashion. Something's been left out of them, and they could only whisper through the wall between the worlds. There must be sadder things, but at this moment he can't think of a single one. Jack looks around at the ruined tent, which seems to breathe with sunshine and shadow. Rags flap. In the next room, through a hole in the gauzy cloth wall, he sees a few overturned cots. What is this place? He asks. She smiles. To some, a hospital. Oh? He looks up and once more takes note of the cross. Maroon now, but undoubtedly once red. A red cross, stupid, he thinks. Oh, but isn't it a little... well, old. Sophie's smile widens, and Jack realizes it's ironic. Whatever sort of hospital this is, or was, he's guessing it bears little or no resemblance to the ones on General Hospital or ER. Yes, Jack, very old. Once there were a dozen or more of these tents in the territories on World and Midworld. Now there are only a few. Mayhap, just this one. Today it's here, tomorrow. Sophie raises her hands, then lowers them. Anywhere, perhaps even on Judy's side of the wall. Sort of like a traveling medicine show. This is supposed to be a joke, and he's startled when she first nods, then laughs and claps her hands. Yes, yes indeed, although you wouldn't want to be treated here. What exactly is she trying to say? I suppose not, he agrees, looking at the rotting walls, tattered ceiling panels, and ancient support posts. Doesn't exactly look sterile. Seriously, but her eyes are sparkling, Sophie says,
Yet if you were a patient, you would think it beautiful out of all measure. And you would think your nurses, the little sisters, the most beautiful any poor patient ever had. Jack looks around. Where are they? The little sisters don't come out when the sun shines. And if we wish to continue our lives with the blessing, Jack, we'll be gone our separate ways from here long before dark. It pains him to hear her talk of separate ways, even though he knows it's inevitable. The pain doesn't dampen his curiosity, however. Once a coppiceman, it seems always a coppiceman. Why? Because the little sisters are vampires, and their patients never get well. Startled, uneasy, Jack looks around for signs of them. Certainly disbelief doesn't cross his mind. A world that can spawn werewolves can spawn anything, he supposes. She touches his wrist. A little tremble of desire goes through him. Don't fear, Jack. They also serve the beam. All things serve the beam. What beam? Never mind. The hand on his wrist tightens. The one who can answer your questions will be here soon, if he's not already. She gives him a sideways look that contains a glimmer of a smile. And after you hear him, you'll be more apt to ask questions that matter. Jack realizes that he has been neatly rebuked, but coming from her, it doesn't sting. He allows himself to be led through room after room of the great and ancient hospital. As they go, he gets a sense of how really huge this place is. He also realizes that in spite of the fresh breezes, he can detect a faint, unpleasant undersmell, something that might be a mixture of fermented wine and spoiled meat. As to what sort of meat, Jack is afraid he can guess pretty well. After visiting over 100 homicide crime scenes, he should be able to. It would have been impolite to break away while Jack was meeting the love of his life, not to mention bad narrative business. So we didn't. Now, however, let us slip through the thin walls of the hospital tent. Outside is a dry but not unpleasant landscape of red rocks, broom sage, desert flowers that look a bit like seagull lilies, stunted pines, and a few barrel cacti. Somewhere not too far distant is the steady, cool sigh of a river. The hospital pavilion rustles and flaps as dreamily as the sails of a ship riding down the sweet chute of the trade wind. As we float along the great ruined tent's east side in our effortless and peculiarly pleasant way, we notice a strew of litter. There are more rocks with drawings etched on them. There is a beautifully made copper rose that has been twisted out of shape as if by some great heat. There is a small rag rug that looks as if it has been chopped in two by a meat cleaver. There's other stuff as well, stuff that has resisted any change in its cyclonic passage from one world to the other. We see the blackened husk of a television picture tube lying in a scatter of broken glass, several Duracell AA batteries, a comb, and, perhaps oddest, a pair of white nylon panties with the word Sunday written on one side in demure pink script. There has been a collision of worlds. Here, along the east side of the hospital pavilion, is an intermingled detritus that attests to how hard that collision was. At the end of that littery plume of exhaust, the head of the comet, we might say, sits a man we recognize. We're not used to seeing him in such an ugly brown robe. And he clearly doesn't know how to wear such a garment, because if we look at him from the wrong angle, we can see much more than we want to. Or wearing sandals instead of wingtips, or with his hair pulled back into a rough horsetail and secured with a hank of rawhide. But this is undoubtedly Wendell Green. He is muttering to himself. Drool drizzles from the corners of his mouth.
He is looking fixedly at an untidy crumple of foolscap in his right hand. He ignores all the more cataclysmic changes that have occurred around him, and focuses on just this one. If he can figure out how his Panasonic mini-corder turned into a little pile of ancient paper, perhaps he'll move on to the other stuff. Not until then. Wendell, we'll continue to call him Wendell, shall we, and not worry about any name he might or might not have in this little corner of existence, since he doesn't know it or want to, spies the Duracell AA batteries. He crawls to them, picks them up, and begins trying to stick them into the little pile of foolscap. It doesn't work, of course, but that doesn't keep Wendell from trying. As George Rathbun might say, give that boy a fly swatter and he'd try to catch dinner with it. Get, says the Cooley Country's favorite investigative reporter, repeatedly poking the batteries at the foolscap. Get in. Get in. Get, damn it. Get in. The... A sound, the approaching jingle of what can only be, God help us, spurs, breaks into Wendell's concentration, and he looks up with wide, bulging eyes. His sanity may not be gone forever, but it's certainly taken the wife and kids and gone to Disney World. Nor is the current vision before his eyes apt to coax it back any time soon. Once in our world, there was a fine black actor named Woody Strode. Lily knew him, acted with him, as a matter of fact, in a late 60s American international stinkeroo called Execution Express. The man now approaching the place where Wendell Green crouches with his batteries and his handful of foolscap looks remarkably like that actor. He is wearing faded jeans, a blue chambray shirt, a neck scarf, and a heavy revolver on a wide leather gun belt in which 4 dozen or so shells twinkle. His head is bald, his eyes deep set. Slung over one shoulder by a strap of intricate design is a guitar. Sitting on the other is what appears to be a parrot. The parrot has 2 heads. No, no, says Wendell in a mildly scolding voice. Don't see that. He lowers his head and once more begins trying to cram the batteries into the handful of paper. The shadow of the newcomer falls over Wendell, who resolutely refuses to look up. Howdy, stranger, says the newcomer. Wendell carries on, not looking up. My name's Parkus. I'm the law around these parts. What's your handle? Wendell refuses to respond unless we can call the low grunts issuing from his drool-slicked mouth a response. I ask your name. When... says our old acquaintance, we can't really call him a friend, without looking up. When Del Green, I take your time, Parkus says, not without sympathy. I can wait till your branding iron gets hot.